Today is Tuesday, December 27th, 2022. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jeff St. John. Jeff spells his last name capital S T space J-O-H-N, capital J. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Jeff. How are you today?
Very well, Tom. Hopefully you are also.
Yes, thank you for asking. Jeff, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. We finished up part one. You had gone to Hawaii to work on a bridge job there for a company named Mosman Construction. Is that right? Mosman Construction?
That's correct.
Okay. And that all kind of collapsed. And so what did you do then?
Well, I reached out to a gentleman I had worked with there in Illinois. And he had become a project manager of a bridge that was going to be built in Burlington, Iowa, across the Mississippi River. And that was for Edward Kramer and Son. And once he found out that my employer, his former employer, was going out of business, he mentioned that he needed some people to help him there in that project. So I went and talked with him for a bit when I was home at Christmas time, and made the decision a couple months later to go ahead and pursue that.
So, well, let's back up for a minute.
Going to Iowa.
Christmas of what year was that?
That would have been Christmas of 1990. I went home from Hawaii for that week, for that period of time.
Okay. And the Burlington, this is the town of Burlington. And the bridge is crossing the Mississippi?
Yes, it was going to be at that time a cable-stayed bridge across the Mississippi River.
Okay. What's a cable-stayed bridge?
A cable-stayed bridge is one you've probably seen pictures of. It typically has some concrete towers rising quite a bit above the bridge deck. In this case, the towers were about 300 feet tall, a little over 300 feet tall. And then it has cables that extend from those towers down to the bridge deck to support the bridge deck. There's not very many of them in the western United States. They just did one recently in Long Beach, California. Primarily, they're over the major rivers in the Midwest. Some of the major waterways along the East Coast and Gulf Coast. So at this time, they were still relatively new
okay.
in the United States. This would have been the 12th one built in the United States. And anyway, it had some interest for me, and had quite a bit of interest for me because it was a very complex bridge and had the opportunity to learn quite a bit and work with some people that I had worked with before. So I went ahead and made the choice to join them.
Okay. Kramer, when did they form? And is that K-R-A-M-E-R?
Yes, it is. Edward Kramer and Sons is an older company. I believe they formed in the first, in the 1920 time period.
Okay.
They send back then, it was a family-owned business, and one of the grandsons of the founder was actually owning it at the time I joined, and they primarily worked in the upper Midwest, Colorado, and were just at that point in time starting an Arizona office.
Okay. And was there specialty bridges, or was there specialty kind of any kind of construction, highways and sorts of things?
Primarily bridges.
Okay. What was this bridge at Burlington? I actually went and looked at the bridge project you talked about that you worked for with David, that's a huge, I mean, it's just got these giant concrete foundations that go up, and the highway deck just makes this graceful curve, climbs up to these low mountains, and it's a long bridge.
That had to be to get across the floodplain there in that river area. Yeah.
Got it.
And it did. It that one fit very well into the natural surroundings. It wasn't very obtrusive. It kind of it flowed into it. We engineers normally give architects a hard time, but I got to say that whoever kind of envisioned that, they did well.
Okay. And so the bridge at Burlington, was it, now you mentioned it's a cable stay, and
yes.
When you say cable stay, I think of, well, let's see, the Golden Gate, that's got big towers that are way above the highway deck.
That's a suspension bridge.
Okay,
so when you see the cables actually extend from tower to tower, and then they have suspender cables that actually come down from the main cable,
yes,
support the bridge deck. Those are suspension bridges.
Okay.
Those have monstrously long spans, like the Golden Gate. Sometimes in the neighborhood of a mile long.
Wow.
They're usually used over major crossings where it's difficult or impossible to put intermediate foundations in.
Okay.
So those are. We would call them the apex bridges. They're in a category all their own.
Okay.
Cable stay is the next level down. They tend to, because the cables go directly from the tower down to the bridge deck, they can be fairly long span and are quite often used over navigation channels on the major rivers, things like that. So in Burlington, we had a navigation span of, I believe, 660 foot. So the tower supported the bridge deck over that.
Wow.
But you can see these, some of the longer ones now are well over 1,000 foot spans. I mean, what I worked on later was 1,200 feet.
Wow.
So they can get even bigger than that.
So each tower has to reach out 330 feet.
The towers are typically above the bridge deck, say 30 to 40% of the height of the tower above the bridge deck is usually 30 to 40% of the span.
Okay.
And then for the efficiency of the cable.
Right, and the cable fans out. I'm sort of thinking actually of a fan I might use when I'm hot, and that. The center point where I'd hold with my hand on my little fan keeping me cool is the tower.
Mm-hmm.
in this concept of these cables radiating out from the tower down to the deck.
Yes. Yeah.
What's the kind of the general process to build that between one cable and the next cable?
After the towers are built, I mean, that's the typically what you spend the first year or two on, and what we did in Iowa, we just built the towers, and then the bridge deck typically goes up in sections that are anywhere from 30 to 50 feet long. They connect in, or connect to previously set pieces. They're done in a balanced fashion on either side of the tower.
Huh.
And then once those sections are in place, you put another cable in, down to the leading edge to support it. You put your bridge deck materials on top of that. And then once you have a bridge deck in place over that 30 to 50 foot piece, then it's time to go out and do another 30 to 50 foot piece. You just keep working your way out, adding more cables as you go.
So would you have a crane on the deck that would crane out the next section? Or how would that section get there?
Yes, sir. certainly. That can be done. And that is typically how they are done when they're high-level bridges on the coasts over when they have to have over a 200-foot clearance for the ocean-going vessels to go underneath them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So typically, those would be built just as you explained. They would have some type of a crane, a specialty crane usually, not a traditional crane.
Right.
That is up there on the bridge deck and handles those pieces and works its, it crawls its way out or travels its way out as the bridge deck goes. On the lower level cable-stayed bridges over what I call the navigable rivers of the United States, the Mississippi, the Ohio, and other rivers similar to that, typically the required clearance underneath isn't anywhere near what they are for the ocean-going ships. So we, by Coast Guard standards, I think at normal water levels, you usually have about a 70-foot clearance.
Okay.
And a 70-foot clearance allows you to use a more traditional crane mounted onto a bridge, onto a barge setup. And then it's actually floating on the river, and then it lifts the pieces up. And because it's a bit easier, a bit faster to handle the crane and move the crane when it's down below on the water. But that's not an option on those high-level bridges.
Got it. Okay. So you crane this piece up there, you can hook it on to the existing deck, and then would you run the cable out to the far side and hook the cable on the other side of the thing and kind of get everything all tightened up and then unhook the crane?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a very, very common erection process that would be used.
Okay. So you moved out there then in the spring of 1991.
Yes, that is correct. I think I started there, it was late March, if I remember right.
Okay. And what did you do there?
I started out as a field engineer and did a lot of the coordination supervision in the field with the guys over some of the activities. And then later on, got kind of a promotion again to just another step up where I was over some more activity. So.
And you stayed with that job till it was done?
I stayed with that job till we were just about ready to put traffic on it in the summer of 93. And from that point in time is when I accepted a position out at the Navajo Bridge in Arizona for the same company.
Okay. Was there anybody was there anybody on the Burlington Bridge that ended up working with you out at the Navajo Bridge?
Yes, a couple of folks actually. One was one of our carpenter superintendents from Burlington. His name is Vern Carau, K-A-R-A-U, from northern Wisconsin. He had worked with us for a while there in Iowa, and he had previously gone out to a different project in Arizona. And then when we got the Navajo Bridge and when it came time to start doing some of the carpentry-type work, he came up. And let's see, who else did we get? Oh, and then the same company, we hired a subcontractor in Burlington to erect the steel and the cables, and that was John F. Beasley Corporation. And so got to work with them really closely in some of the activities. I spent a lot of time working with those guys.
And is that B-E-S-L-E-Y? How do they spell Beasley?
B-E-A-S-L-Y. Believe there might be an E in there, I cannot remember for sure.
Okay, we'll probably look it up online.
Yes, and so they were there, that we hired them to come and set the steel.
Okay.
And they brought in one of their specialty cranes that was on a barge, and they did the steel erection. It was about from early 92 through late 90. some of those folks, when John F. Beasley went out of business, the manager of that company, a gentleman named Jay Rollins, he formed a division of a company to do steel erection with the Trailer Brothers. And Trailer Brothers is a large Midwestern contractor, kind of central Midwest. And they did not do steel erection previously to that. So he started this business up with them, their division up with them. They're from a similar neighborhood where Rollins was based. He was based in western Kentucky, almost where it hit the Mississippi River. And Trailer Brothers is right on the Ohio River, just a couple hundred miles at most upstream. So he was very familiar with those people. And he started this company up. We hired them to be the steel erector at Navajo Bridge.
Okay.
And
so we being Kramer.
One or two of the folks that worked in Burlington, who I didn't really know very well, came out to the Navajo Bridge to do the steel erection there.
Okay, so would that be like their bolt-up crew or their erection crew guys? Or?
They didn't bring too many people out. They hired mostly Navajo Nation iron workers.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a few in the unions, and they're so they hired most of their crew came from there. They brought out a core group of four or five guys.
Jeff, I'm going to have to put the phone down for just a minute. I take notes as we're talking, and my little pen is going turtle here, so I'm going to be right back. Hang on a second. Sorry about that.
No problem.
It always fails when you don't have a backup. It's just the way it goes. Okay, it's kind of complicated here. Make sure I get this right.
Sure.
The job in Burlington, Kramer used Beasley to help with some of the erection of the bridge, the steel bits.
Yes.
Beasley then went bust. Uh-huh. And some of the Beasley people, in this case Jay Rollins, went to Trailer Brothers and started a division, a steel division in Trailer.
That is correct, yes.
Okay. All right. And then Kramer got the job for the Navajo Bridge and subcontracted the steel erection to Trailer.
That's correct, yes. So we were awarded the contract, I want to say, around May or June of 1993. And then I was asked to go out there, and actually it's my first job as project manager.
Okay.
So they had me go on out there. I got there in July of 93. And as the project manager, over basically all of it from the contracting side. And we hired several subcontractors to work on the job. We hired Ames Construction to do the excavation and road work that were associated with the project. And Ames had a group there out of Phoenix. And so they came up to do the excavation and road work. And of course, that's effectively the first stuff that happens on these jobs.
Okay.
Was to get the excavation going. And then we hired another company called Barcone. I believe it was Fred Barcone out of the Arizona did masonry work.
Okay.
If you see the pictures of the project, you'll see there was a lot of stone masonry that was done on the job. So this company did that. And we had Trailer Brothers we hired to be the steel erector on the job. And so they came out a little bit later and did that. We had a number of other smaller subcontractors. Those were the primary subs.
Okay. When let's back up a little bit. Had you been out to Arizona before on any other jobs?
No, my own, not to work. No, it was my first time to work. I had driven through Arizona on my way to Hawaii. That was my
So I'm assuming you were on the I-40 corridor, you know, through Flagstaff and
yeah.
Kingman, and
yeah. Pulled in the Flagstaff in the evening in my open Jeep and wondered why I was freezing. Spent the night there, and then I happened, you know, pre-internet. I had no way of knowing, and I cannot even remember what it was, but I had a device that could measure altitude, and I looked at that, and I'm like, oh, well, now I know why I'm freezing.
In an open Jeep, you must have been bundled up. Oh, my gosh. Huh. So when you got to the job site there, in, it's like July 1993, what was your first thought?
Well, it was a stunning area. I did get to visit it before I actually worked out there. You know, we moved out there. I got to visit it and look around a bit, meet a few of the people that will say with the Arizona DOT. Gentleman there with Kramer that was kind of helping get the project kicked off till I could arrive and hand it off to me. So met them, just again stunned at the scenery of the background, the vastness of the area that was all new to me at that time. And just overwhelmed in many ways by that. The project itself was an interesting project, but it wasn't terribly complicated. But the scene for the project was real grabbing.
Yeah. It's definitely a gorgeous place. Okay, so you came out and looked at it, and then came out to, so it would have been July of 93 when you came out to sort of take over being the project manager?
Yes.
Okay. Where did you stay?
We stayed, most of us that were working there stayed at the Marble Canyon Lodge while we were working.
Okay.
Some of the folks would commute. They had homes and other parts of the state. They would go home on the weekend. But at least at this point in time, I was there full time. And so we rented some of the units that the lodge had available.
Okay.
And I rented a duplex technically the company rented it. The living room was the project office. The kitchen was kind of a combination of office area and kitchen for me, and then I lived in one of the bedrooms.
Okay.
There. So, and that was true of a number of folks that were there. Ames did the same thing. They were there at that time, or they were showing up at that time, I guess you could say. So they rented a couple of the duplexes that were there, and the Arizona DOT rented one of the duplexes to use as their office. They didn't stay at the job. They all lived up in Page. But they rented a duplex to use as their office. So we were all in that group of buildings that was right there next to Marble Canyon Lodge. And then a number of workers rented rooms there at the lodge. Or we would rent rooms for them, at least for a short period of time.
Okay. Can you lay out the landscape for us? How far is it from the lodge and the places you all rented and the job site?
Very close, very close. So the bridge spans between the Navajo Nation and Bureau of Land Management property and Park Service property just on the west side of the river. If you go less than half a mile on Highway 89A, that's where Marble Canyon is, the community of Marble Canyon. So at that community, you had the Marble Canyon Lodge, which by far the largest establishment there. There was three or four private homes. There were some units that were some of the lodge workers lived in across the highway. There was a small airstrip there, so you'd get some small planes that would take off and land there, especially bringing in people that were going to go fly fishing on the Colorado or go on raft trips. And then there was, trying to count in my head here, eight duplexes, I believe. Something like that.
Okay.
Might have been six. But, yeah, so it was just a small community there. There was a post office, a gas station, a trading post. It was all of it associated with the lodge. And so that was the only community there. There was probably 20 people or less that lived there full-time normally. So we significantly increased the full-time population of the area. Then another, 6, 7, 8 miles down the road, you had another community called, they call themselves BC, Vermilion Cliffs. There's a lodge there called Lee's Ferry at Vermilion Cliffs. There were a number of actual private properties there and private residences. There's probably another 30 people that live there.
So did you walk then basically from excuse me, did you walk from your office to the job site?
Oh no, I had a pickup truck.
Okay.
So just running around in a pickup truck, especially if I had to. Early on, we started most of the efforts on the east side of the river on the reservation property. That's where we had to get the initial excavations done. Excavations for the arch foundation had to be done over there to get started. So the first, at least 6 months of the project were almost entirely spent on the east side of the river.
Oh, okay.
We started coming over to the west.
Got it. So you just drive across the old bridge.
Yep.
and go to the work site there. Okay.
Yeah.
Summer 1993. It's hot. More kind of. It would be warmish, but dry, not too humid, maybe, compared to Kentucky.
Some of the monsoons, that's what I learned about monsoons. So we had the monsoon flowing through, so it was a little more humid than I thought it would be.
Okay.
It was not as hot as, certainly not as hot as the low desert. You know, this is high desert area. The elevation's around 3,500 feet.
Right.
So it was, occasionally it got over 110. Not all that often. Typically, our typical summer day there was in the 105-degree range. So hot, but not oppressively hot.
Okay.
As you get to lower elevation, as I learned years later working near Las Vegas.
Ooh. Yeah, that's hot. Getting hotter. Okay, so what were... Let's see, first thing that had to happen was on the Navajo side, work on the approach to the new bridge location?
Right, so the project extended probably a mile and a half east of the river on the Navajo side, and to realign the highway to line up with the new bridge location.
Okay.
So there was a rather large amount of blasting and excavation that had to happen for the roadway itself. And then, of course, there was the blasting into the canyon walls for the arch foundation. So that's where the focus was. They were working on both. They were working on the roadway excavation and on the structural excavation at the same time.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about both of those? How'd they work and how'd it go?
It's almost entirely rock, so it was almost entirely drilled and blasted.
Okay.
Using conventional blasting means. The roadway excavation did not need to be as controlled as the arch foundation excavation. There was a significant requirement in the contract to not put rock down into the canyon. As you blast it. If you look beneath the existing bridge, you would see that there was a tremendous amount of rock that was let go down into the canyon, and it formed little strips of land down on the riverside down there.
Mm-hmm.
Was not allowed under our contract, so we had to come up with blasting means and methods to blast and not put rock out into the canyon. So it involved we hung a containment net made out of steel cables.
Okay.
on the face of the canyon, and that's a lot of what I was involved with my forces to self-perform. A small team there, so we helped them set that net and cables.
What was the idea with that? So you drill in to the solid rock and you load that rock with explosives, and then with the net was supposed to keep the rock in place. Then after the blast, you could get in there with a track hoe or some sort of equipment to scoop that broken up rock up and then haul it away.
Yeah. So now, normally the net would not take the force of an explosion. So what they had to do, and the blasters that were brains had to do, is come up with a blasting pattern that directed the force of the blast away from the canyon, back towards the solid rock. And that involved a number of techniques that they had, pre-splitting the rock. They had to use the explosives sequence in a certain way that it basically started in a corner and worked its way out and was kept trying to direct the force of the explosion back towards where it had previously exploded rather than the open face of the canyon.
That makes perfect sense. So you start far away from the edge of the cliff and start small and then start doing a hole there and make that bigger and bigger and keep blowing into the open area you made.
Yes.
Okay.
I will say that it worked very well. You know, there were challenges when you got to the very edge. When you got right up against the cliff edge, because then the force of the explosion wants to just find the weakest place.
Ooh.
And so that's where it was the hardest. And then there was a couple of places where there was just rock that it was, because of the existing fractures, there was just no way to prevent it from going into the canyon. So we identified those with the Arizona DOT, and they had to go out with us and agree that trying to do anything fancy with those locations was effectively too dangerous. And then we had to get special permission to actually, when we blasted, to drop those pieces down on the side of the canyon.
Okay.
So that did happen. I think I was rereading something recently that we estimated we probably lost somewhere around 5%, maybe a little more than 5% of the rock going into the canyon, but the rest of it we were able to excavate out. Similar to what you said, we used our crane to set a track hoe down into the excavation. It would remove all the loose rock. We would pull the crane back up out of there, and they would do the next series of shots.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just the process as we worked our way down to the bottom of the excavation.
Okay, and how far did you have to go from the top to the bottom of the cut there?
going to guess, it's been a long time, but I'm going to guess it's 90%.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I'm going to say it was about 80 feet or so.
80 feet.
It's been a long time.
So okay, yeah. So 80 feet down, and then how far, roughly, how far in did you have to cut?
20 to 30 feet.
Okay.
Basically, that the goal there was to get back far enough away that you were in competent rock,
mm-hmm.
where the fractures were, no visible fractures. And that had been determined before we were awarded the contract, the approximate location, because they had done a series of test bores in the rock to try to find where the fractures were. By and large, I think they did a good job with that program. It's always hard, just through test bores, to try to figure that out. But they went that far enough that they felt comfortable that the foundations would be behind the natural fractures.
And then once that was, once that notch was put in there, I'm assuming the next thing to do would be to put in some concrete for the foundations.
Yeah, and that, so those were my crews that was our self-performed work. We went in and did the foundations after the excavation was completely formed and poured, placed the rebar and all those good things to make the arch foundations.
Okay. And did you just like bring out a concrete truck from Flagstaff, turning concrete in the back of the truck all the way out there, and then just like, how'd you get that concrete down there?
No, we set up a mobile batch plant.
Okay.
Not too far from the job site. We did consider that. We considered bringing concrete from Page, which is the nearest plant.
Ah.
And then Page is still, for a concrete truck, close to an hour drive, and that's just too far.
Okay.
Especially back in those days, we did not have the chemicals that would delay the hydration of the concrete sufficiently to make a haul that long.
Okay.
Kind of temperatures. So we set up a batch plant nearby, and then we had, depended upon how large the concrete placement was going to be, sometimes we had several trucks that we would have there. Usually they could get by with one or two trucks that would deliver the, because it was so close, it didn't take any time at all to actually haul the concrete to the job site.
Right, if you guys were just with a batch plant right there up on the flats next to the job site. And then, so the concrete would come out of the truck and they would go into some kind of bucket or something to lower it down?
Yeah, so it was all crane and bucket. So yeah, it would fill a bucket that the crane would then pick up and swing into position.
Okay. And then there would be some sort of foundation pins that, Were they set in the concrete, or were they actually drilled into the solid rock?
No, they were into the concrete. The foundations were, the concrete foundations were keyed into the rock, and then the anchor bolts for the arch itself were cast into the concrete.
Okay. And as all that was going on, I'm assuming that the Ames folks would have scurried over to the Marble Canyon side, the other side of the river, and started working on the cut over there.
Exactly, yes. So they started working. There was a bigger cut. Actually, it wasn't bigger, but it was in order to create a path to where the arch foundation was, they had to do a cut over there. So it took a little bit longer to get to the arch location itself because they had to drill and blast the roadway through the rock so before they could get there. So then, yeah, that's, once we had the west side where we could be putting in structural foundations, the blasters went over to the east side. They went over to the west side to start doing the same thing.
Okay, so they had then to do the same thing over there that you had done, which is prep the landscape for a road to the bridge site, and then prep the bridge site for the foundation.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. How many months did all that take, roughly?
That was well into the spring of 94. Yeah. I'm trying to remember when we started steel erection. I think we started steel erection in the spring of 94.
So, okay.
Yeah. And the excavation was still ongoing on the west side of the river when the steel started showing up on the east side of the river.
Okay. So that was in the spring of 94 that the steel started going in. Again, on the Navajo side?
Yes.
Yeah.
Started on the Navajo side. We had to put in one of the things, again, that my crews had to put in were the temporary foundations and tieback anchors for the steel erection process required in order to be able to cantilever out over the canyon. So we got that done. Shortly after we built the permanent foundation, and then once we were done, then basically we were able to turn that part over to Trailer Brothers so that they could start the installation.
Okay, can you talk to me a little bit about the tieback anchors and how that worked?
Yeah, so those there's a couple different ways you can do them. You can, if you have sufficient space in geology, you can just cast large dead that you embed anchors beams into that will connect to the beams that you use during the erection process. In this case, we did not have the benefit of space or geology, so we cast large blocks of concrete basically against the earth. We cleaned the stuff off of the earth, and we into the rock, but not terribly far. And then we came and we drilled, they call them soil anchors or rock anchors. We had to drill those through sleeves that we had prepared in the concrete blocks, say anywhere from 50 to 70 feet into the natural rock. And then these were, they were post-tension cables we discussed a bit about yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Those were inserted. The hole was filled with grout. Once the grout had cured to a certain strength, then you could start tensioning those cables so that they would provide the resistance necessary for the steel erection process. So the cables were tensioned. Then we had the steel beams cast into the concrete that the erection process connected to, and once everything was prepared, then the steel erection could proceed.
So, make sure I have this figured out. There's a foundation over the edge and down a ways, and then up top is the anchor. So you're going to build out essentially a diving board, and it's going to be anchored at the top to the rock, to the solid rock there, so that the diving board stays level as you build it out and doesn't teeter off and tip down into the gorge below.
That's the goal, yes.
Okay.
Here's a pretty good schematic of that in one of those magazine articles I sent you.
Yeah, I saw that. And yeah. Thank you. I'm just trying to get it on the record here. 100 years from now, somebody listen to this thing and go, how'd they do that? Okay, so you've got the anchors set, you've got the foundations set. Where did the steel come from?
The steel was manufactured by a fabricator named Vincent Steel. So Vincennes, Indiana is where they fabricate that.
V-I-N-C-E-N-S?
Two N's. Yeah, V-I-N-S. Yeah. So V-I-N-C-E-N-N-E-S.
Thank you.
Yes. And so Vincent Steel did the fabrication. That was part of our contract with Divided Steel. And we then provided it to Trailer Brothers for them to use the erection.
Okay.
And there were some temporary members that had to be fabricated to work with the erection scheme that the trailer brothers wanted to use. And they've been since provided most of that. Some of it we procured locally there in Arizona. So then the big thing for me for the next several months there, once we had all the arch foundations done on both sides, was do what I could to help the iron workers, you know, make sure they had the steel they needed and when they needed it, where they needed it, any other help we could give them while they did the steel erection.
Who was the Trailer Brothers superintendent?
That was Ed Kent. He had come out of retirement to do that job. Very, very nice gentleman. I have nothing but good things to say about Ed. I've worked with a lot of iron workers, both subcontractors and self-perform, and he is certainly tied for first among the qualities and class of the guys I've worked with.
Tell me more about him. How would you describe him, and what were his mannerisms?
Ed was a tall, thin gentleman from, I believe, Central Tennessee. So he had a bit of a Southern accent. Very, very calm, very cool. He had seen everything in you know, many of our construction trades, and ironworkers included. You get a lot of excitable people there, a lot of people that want to scream and yell all the time. Ed was not one of those guys. Ed would put a stop to it real fast if some of his folks started behaving that way. He taught me a lot of how I needed to work with my guys later on. Just, you know, listen to them, but you know, keep everybody focused on the goal, do things right, do things once. Safety, you know, one of the things that they didn't have to do, but they elected to do there was install a system of safety nets underneath the lower arch pieces as they went out in case people on, you know, when they were walking out on the steel happened to slip and fall. There's a number of reasons they did that. By doing that, then for a good part of it, they didn't have to tie off if there was another safety mechanism in place. You know,
oh.
Guys were productive. So that was from the production side. There was some good reasons to do that. Very expensive net system, you know, and required quite a bit of effort to put up. So it was also for the worker safety.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you had fallen from the top portion of the arch of the structure, you probably would have gotten hurt very badly. So when you were up on those top portions, you still were required to tie off as you went out with your body belts and lanyards and whatnot. But on the lower pieces, it made life a lot easier to get out to the work front, to where the steel was being set, or later on when we were starting to do some of the follow-on work. So it was a good system.
Okay.
So.
Nice. So Ed sounded like, just as you say, kind of calm, cool, and collected.
Yep. Tall, thin. I seem to recall him smoking pretty much. Hopefully that's correct. And spoke slowly. Thought about what he was going to say before he said it. Could think more than a day or two ahead, which is not always the case with a lot of guys.
Okay.
So he and I were able to do a lot of planning for things that needed to occur weeks or months in the future and have the right things, the right tools, the right equipment, the right materials available when we got to those stages.
Nice.
It worked out real well.
Very nice. That's got to be handy. And then I'm assuming that Ed would have been, he would have set the tone for the job.
For the iron workers, he certainly did.
Yeah, is what you're saying. I mean, not shouting, not running around, not not high-paced manic, but just calm, cool, collected. This is what we're going to do.
Exactly.
Okay. And had you worked with Ed before?
No, I had not.
Okay.
I think the only gentleman that I remember from Trailer, that I remember his name, is Dave Mesh, M-E-C-H-E, was one of their foremen that came out. He might have been considered a general foreman on the job. He had been in Burlington for a short period of time.
Okay.
So I knew him from there. I think he's from, well, he's definitely a Southerner. All those guys are Southerners. I think he might have been from Louisiana.
Okay.
I don't know for sure. But, yeah, so he was there. We had a couple other guys I don't remember their names. I think I had worked with one of the other guys before.
Okay. And if I get this right, I mean, this is not an atypical bridge build where there's a contractor, many subcontractors, a few people might have worked together on a few other jobs, but for the most part, all the many players didn't really know each other and hadn't worked with each other before.
In our line of work, in bridge work, that's extremely common.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just trying to.
And then, depending upon the union agreements that you have, those union agreements tell you how many of your people you're allowed to bring into an area versus have to hire locally. And so, there was a big focus there to hire locally, hire Navajo workers with a specific emphasis on the project.
Okay.
So. Trailer Brothers, similar to the Kramer crews, I had a couple of key guys I brought in from other locations, but the majority of my guys were Navajos, right, not necessarily from right in that vicinity, as Navajo reservation is huge, but they were Navajos, and the same with the iron workers. I think their contract required them to hire at least 60% of their workforce from the local union hall.
Okay. And I think that local union hall is in Phoenix, isn't it?
Believe so. Yes, I would say so. And then the local union hall, as for all the trades, were advised that if there were any Navajo workers available, those were the guys they were required to dispatch.
Okay, so the Navajo would get preference then?
Yes.
Okay.
That's part of the contract with the DOT.
Yeah.
Our contract with the DOT required a certain commitment to participation by local labor.
Which makes perfect sense. It's their land, it's their locale, so yeah.
Yep.
Cool. Now I'm trying to figure this out. Ed's a Southern gentleman. David Mesh, also from the South. I'm assuming that the trailer bridge people, iron workers, that 40% that they brought in would have mostly been Southern folks.
Yes. I would guarantee that it was 100% correct.
Okay. I personally have a hard time. I'm, you know, sort of an Arizona person. I have a hard time understanding Southern accents.
You're not the only one, and I grew up semi in the South, and I've worked with those guys most of my career. So, yes, there was a lot of what did he say type thing. the same from the Navajo side, too. So, the Navajo side certainly presented some challenges to all of us.
Right. So, I would assume that like me, the Arizona Navajo guys hadn't been familiarized with the South language, and of course the Southerners didn't speak Navajo. How did they bridge that gap?
Normally, knowing Dave, he just yelled at them loud enough so they understood. in a good way. Dave was a good guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, that's, considerate. And that wasn't, again, that was my guys too, with my supervision that I had there. And they would listen, and then, you know, sometimes they'd go out and do it like you asked them to, and sometimes they'd just go out and do it how they wanted to do it anyway. You have to try to talk to them again. So.
Yeah, I imagine that there wouldn't be a lot of freeboard to be creative. I mean, this piece of steel has to go there, and the bolt holes have to line up. I suppose where the variety could be in is exactly, you know, where you're going to stand or you know, how you're going to swing that piece in there.
Right. I think the main thing on a structure like that is with that type of erection process is don't take shortcuts. If the plan says put 37 bolts in before you cut the crane free, put 37 bolts in or more. You don't put 32 in. So that's...
Yeah.
A lot of what you do is to make sure people follow the process that they need to follow to do it correctly.
Okay. That
and
makes sense.
With your bolting, there's certain requirements to how you tension the bolts and make sure that they get adequate tension in them. It's very easy for guys to try to take shortcuts on that kind of item.
How so? I mean, you gotta put the bolt in and you gotta torque it up to a certain amount of force. How do you shortcut that?
You don't put it through a certain amount of force. You stop when you feel like stopping. So, because it takes a lot of effort to do bolts correctly. And I've learned more and more about this throughout my career since then, even. That is one of the hardest things to do is to get guys to tension bolts correctly to meet the requirements. It's so easy to stop early or to put bolts in improperly. You know, you have to put lubrication on the bolts. You have to, but not too much lubrication before you tension them so that this is just friction that you're tensioning against. There's a certain process for bolting in what sequence you tension the bolts in a connection. Usually it's from the center out, not start from the edge and work in. It's just doing all these kind of things properly, and that is really what separates the professional, the real good professional iron worker crews from the kind of lazy iron worker crews that we see far too often, is their dedication to doing that, those kind of things correctly. And I will say that I think they did a fine job out there. But then I think the Arizona DOT inspectors that were out there watching them would agree with me.
Uh-huh. Yep. So when I think of a bolt that needs to be tightened to a certain torque, a certain amount of tightness, you know, I do this on my car. I've got a little gauge, and I put the you know, socket on the end of this thing. It's got a long needle and a handle on it, and I simply pull that around until the needle rolls on out to the number I'm looking for, and I'm done. How does it work in iron on a bridge?
So there's a number of methods now, but the primary method that would have been used back then is what they call the turn of the nut method, which is you install the bolt, you snug them up, and talk to what they are considered snug tight. And before you put the impact wrench on them, these are large diameter, usually they're using air-driven impact wrenches to tighten the bolt. You mark the bolt against the washer so that you can, and then you put the impact wrench on there and you monitor the rotation of the nut against the starting point. And so you have a certain amount of rotation that you're trying to get that you have previously calibrated on the land to say, okay, if I get, just throwing a number out there, if I get 120 degrees of rotation, that equals the required torque.
Okay.
That's been verified using a calibrated measuring device on the land. So that's how it should be done, and I believe that's how it was done there. And then every now and then, the inspectors will come out with a big, long-handled, traditional torque wrench, just much, you know, with a 6-foot arm on it instead of a 2-foot arm on it.
Wow.
And they will actually, they will set the required, they will have calibrated that torque wrench on against that calibration device on land also. And then they'll go out and they'll put it on a certain percentage of the bolts, usually somewhere 10% or 2 per connection is kind of a very common requirement. And they'll verify that the bolts that were tensioned using air-driven impact wrenches did achieve the proper amount of torque. And if they fail, usually then they have to, the crews have to go back out there and basically torque wrench the entire connection to show that all of them are good.
Right. And ideally, you wouldn't want to do that because that would be time. You know, do it once, do it right, and you don't have to go back and think with it again.
Exactly. And so it's the time of actually doing the connection, but it also has the potential to stop erection out in front of you, too.
Ooh.
So there's a lot of focus on it.
Okay. So the snug tight.
Before you have an erection crew and a bolt up crew, that's fairly common.
Right.
That's how they proceeded there. I can tell if they had one or two bolt up crews, but obviously they had one erection crew. So the erection would proceed, they would put the bare minimum in of bolts as they erected, and then the bolt up crew would come to follow up behind them and fill the remaining holes and install them.
Oh, okay, so the erection people wouldn't necessarily do more than just snug tight.
Quite often, not more than snug tight. Different projects have different requirements, but that would be very common because they would just snug tight for a certain amount of bolts.
Got it. That makes sense. And then the bolt up people would have to pay attention, make sure that whatever that amount of rotation happened.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Usually in the erection process, a common rule of thumb, which does vary project to project, but a common rule of thumb is 50% of the bolts get put in during the erection, and then the other 50% get put in during the connection.
Okay. And that, you know, that it just makes perfect sense without a live load, without a deck overhead, without, you know, a regular working bridge, you could put out some steel or a lot of steel even with half the bolts and just, you know, everything's lined up right. You've got these bolts in there and you can go ahead and build that out a ways. Not too far, but certainly a ways.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, Jeff, once again, we have burned through another hour here. Does this sound like a good place to put a comma in this interview series?
Well, it probably makes more sense just to take this one to the end. It wouldn't take too much longer.
I'm going to ask you a lot of questions. if you're willing, to put a comma here, maybe we should do that because you'll be trying to go fast and I'll be trying to slow you down. Okay.
I'm not sure when the next time is going to be available. It's probably going to be, let me look at the calendar here, probably in 3 weeks.
Okay. That'd be fine. Is there anything else you want to add about the material we've covered?
No, I think we've done a good job of describing what's going on at that point in the job and what is
All right. Sounds good. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and conclude part 2 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Jeff St. John. Today is Tuesday, December 27th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Jeff, thank you so very much.